coming up on Philosophy Talk.
It's one thing to, when you have a test where you know exactly what it means, and I think that's what we envision when we think about genetic testing.
Is knowing more about our genes necessarily a good thing?
What do you say to somebody when we have genetic findings of unknown significance, which is incredibly common?
Should we limit the amount of information we can learn about our genes?
If you really accept that giving genetic information about health risks is a medical process, is part of medicine, then it's really important that it be done right and that the information be correct and actionable.
How can we separate genetic fact from genetic fiction?
Diagnostics is a part of medicine.
Our guest is David Magnus, director of the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics.
Giving information is an intervention, just like giving a drug, and we should make sure that it's a safe and effective one.
Bioethics, myths and realities, coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates on the other side of the Bay at Stanford University. There at Philosopher's Corner, Ken and I teach philosophy.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about bioethics, myths and realities.
Well, developments in genetics, in particular the mapping of the human genome, are tremendously exciting. For example, if we could correctly identify the disease-carrying genes, we might be able to eradicate cancer.
Yeah, John, I get it, but you know, new knowledge gives us new abilities gives us new ethical dilemmas. And this is so true in the field of biology that they had to invent a whole new discipline to deal with these dilemmas. That's the field of bioethics.
Well, not too much ethically problematic about eradicating cancer, is there?
Well, no, but think about, say, designer babies. I mean, sounds pretty benign if you're just envisioning parents who choose to have, you know, healthy, intelligent, maybe good-looking kids. But it's frightening if you think of that power and knowledge in the hands of a latter-day Hitler.
Well, Kent, your fears are overblown. The idea of designer babies is a myth. It's not a scientific reality. We can't literally reach into an embryo and kind of give it the genes for the traits we want the child to have. We just don't have that kind of power.
We don't have that kind of power yet. But look, even short of that frightening scenario, we can still use our vast knowledge of the human genome to decide whether or not to implant a particular embryo on the basis of its particular genetic makeup. And that way, we don't have to design the genes directly into the embryo.
Well, now, what you're thinking of is PGD. That's short for pre-implantation genetic diagnosis. And the way that works is this. Suppose a couple is worried about passing on a genetic disease. Their eggs and sperm are combined to produce embryos outside the womb. Then these embryos are tested, and only the disease-free ones get implanted. Now, what's the ethical dilemma in that?
Well, you can use PGD to make sure that you have a boy rather than a girl, can't you?
Well, big deal. Why shouldn't parents have the freedom to choose the gender of their offspring? Why should it be left to chance?
Well, and couldn't you use PGD to, I don't know, determine hair color or eye color or make sure they have pale or dark skin or whatever?
Well, if somebody is, you know, caught up in those superficial characteristics, yes, they could. But again, what so what?
Well, what about athletic ability or intelligence?
Ah, I see where you're going. You're going back to the myth of designer babies. You're using PGD to sneak these little babies through the back door.
Well, exactly, John, exactly. But what's wrong with that way of thinking?
Because you're back in the realm of science fiction. You're assuming we know a lot more about how genes produce traits than we actually do. Some traits, and disease traits among them, and maybe some basic ones like hair color, these we do understand to the point where we could, you know, do a little engineering. But athletic ability, intelligence, these depend on a whole host of factors not just genetic factors, environmental factors, and not just one gene, zillions of genes. So nothing like what you're imagining is on the horizon.
Oh, John, I wish I could be as sanguine as you are. I wish I could.
What's up with you today, Ken? You fall off the wrong side of the bed? You're usually such a gung-ho optimist about science and technology. Why so pessimistic?
Because, John, our knowledge and our power are quickly outpacing our wisdom. Take a little simple thing like the ability to choose the gender of your offspring. I mean, look, left to its own devices, human reproduction has evolved over millions of years so that slightly more males are produced than females. But you know, once we start mucking around with reproduction, the natural gender balance is bound to get all out of whack. And that could have enormous downside consequences for our cultures and our societies.
You're just focusing on the downside and the downside of things that may not ever happen anyway. You should focus more on the upside of the here and now. For example, we can now determine whether a person has genes that predispose him to Alzheimer's. Don't you think that's a good thing?
Well, there's no known cure for Alzheimer's, right? So look, if you were to find out right now, right here on this stage, that you're predisposed to get it, what could you do about it? Nothing, not a thing. What's that knowledge going to do for you? It's just going to make you miserable. So look, why bother?
What were we talking about?
Alzheimer's.
Oh, yeah. Well, Ken, you know, I'm not going to be able to talk you out of your pessimism, at least not in this segment. But if we were to separate science fiction from science fact, that would at least ease some of your worries, I bet, at least a little.
Well, you know, to that end, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Ash, to find examples of the kind of genetic science fiction John's been accusing me of wallowing in. She files this report.
There's a great scene in the 1978 thriller, The Boys from Brazil. Ezra Lieberman, the aging Nazi hunter played by Laurence Olivier, figures out Nazis have impregnated women with embryos that are clones of Hitler.
Not Mozart, doctor. Not Picasso. Not a genius who would enrich the world. But a lonely little boy with a domineering father and an affectionate, doting mother.
The very notion that you could reproduce somebody's qualities, somebody's behavioral qualities, by cloning them is ridiculous.
Dr. Jonathan Moreno teaches medical ethics and health policy at the University of Pennsylvania. He's also a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress in Washington. But more importantly, he's a sci-fi fan. And he says the popular notion that cloning creates an exact double in all ways, including personality, is totally outlandish.
Behavior is a very complicated phenomenon. The fact is that we come out with a very wide set of possible permutations of behaviors, and then it depends on all kinds of environmental factors that we are not even beginning to understand.
When The Boys from Brazil came out in the 70s, Moreno says only a handful of people in the bioethics field were talking about cloning. But by the 90s, cloning and stem cell research were issues that divided presidential candidates.
Science fiction examples like cloning a Big Brother type using only his nose or making lots of Adolf Hitlers are very good examples for stimulating thought about ethics, but they're really bad cases for developing public policy.
I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist.
Another great topic for fantasy writers is genetic engineering. If you can engineer out disease, what else is possible? In the 1997 film Gattaca, a baby's medical future is known minutes after birth.
Neurological condition, 60% probability. Manic depression, 42% probability. Attention deficit disorder, 89% probability. Heart disorder, 99% probability. Early fatal potential. Life expectancy, 30.2 years.
Professor Moreno says reproduction and genetic engineering are great for sci-fi writers because the field is progressing so quickly.
Now there are thousands of biomarkers for embryos in a dish. You can tell a lot about what you're going to get or what you're not going to get. There are fertility clinics that have in the past advertised that they'll give you your money back if you don't get a baby with a certain hair color or skin tone or eye color that you want.
Now, it's one thing to breed beautiful, intelligent, disease-free babies. But what about breeding genetically engineered super soldiers? That's a question explored in films like The Bourne Legacy and Hannah.
Tamika.
Mursavika.
Then.
Postcard.
If what else?
Adapt or die.
Think on your feet.
Even when I'm sleeping.
Moreno doesn't think super soldiers are a high priority for the military, but he does see a future in developing neurotechnologies that sharpen a soldier's skills by enhancing the brain and nervous system.
That could be anything from keeping somebody sharp, even though they're in a combat situation with, you know, high levels of stress and have only slept 3 or 4 hours, to ultimately certain kinds of implants that could, for example, enable a warfighter to know a language when he or she walks into an alien country.
Whether they explore themes of cloning, genetic engineering, or bridging the man-machine divide, Moreno says these films all have something in common.
How far is biology, you know, permitted to go? What kinds of experiments? Are there any experiments that are beyond the pale? And are there certain questions that shouldn't be asked?
Now that sounds like a question for philosophers. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
Thanks, Caitlin. That was very interesting. Ken, it looks like you can check off Hitler clones. Cross that off from your list of worries. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow philosopher at Stanford, Ken Taylor. And we're coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley.
Our guest today is director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the Stanford School of Medicine. He's also co-editor of a book with the provocative title, Who Owns Life? Please welcome David Magnus.
David, you earned your PhD in the Stanford Philosophy Department. Now, we exposed you to some fascinating issues, like how do proper names work? Or what's the difference between moving your arm and having your arm just go up? What excuse do you have to move from those fascinating issues into this bizarre field of bioethics? How did that happen?
Yeah, what went wrong? I've always been interested in the intersection between biology and ethics, even when I was a graduate student. But one of my professors when I was at Stanford, at the end of every talk, always said at the end, so what? So the idea of trying to explore the real-world implications of the work that I was doing was something that was very, very important to me, and it sort of gradually led me away from philosophy departments and into the world of the School of Medicine.
So can you give us, Ken in particular, a little reality check? Are designer babies really on the horizon? Do we need to get a kind of a head start thinking about all the moral dilemmas designer babies are going to raise?
Yeah, so there's certainly a lot of ethical issues, but I think designer babies really aren't one of them. We were very worried about this in the late 90s, early 2000s. The advances in genetics was happening at an incredible pace, but it turns out it's a lot more complicated than we thought it was going to be. It's been very disappointing. But for complex traits, which are the kinds of things people really care about when they think about designer babies, intelligence, and so on, it's much more complicated than we thought, and we're not going to be able to understand the genetics of that for a long time.
For a long time. But someday, will we? Is it off in the distant future, or is it never going to happen? Just to clarify that.
Well, I think once you get more than about 25 years out on the horizon, we have sort of a rule of thumb in bioethics that if it's more than 25 years from now, best not to spend too much time worrying about that yet. There are real-world problems we can deal with now.
Okay, so name me a real-world problem that you think philosophers and society and social people ought to be dealing with right here, right now.
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of things that we have to deal with genetics. The one thing is issues about privacy and control. The people in the audience here may not be aware of the fact that probably most of them already have their DNA somewhere where they can be used for research. So there's issues about privacy and control. Almost every child right now is at birth genetically tested, and as the explosion of information with sequencing happens, the decisions about which information is going to be returned and all the nitty-gritty details about how we're going to really handle this explosion of information is already upon us.
So in the vault somewhere sitting there right now may be somebody's complete genetic information. That's a frightening thought. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in Berkeley. We're talking about the myths and realities of bioethics with David Magnus from the Stanford School of Medicine.
We've been trying to separate myths and realities about bioethics. In our next segment, we're going to deal into something that really is a reality. What David has just mentioned, physicians are faced with difficult decisions about which genetic tests they should perform, and having performed them, what results they should share with patients. Is there a case for less than full disclosure? Or do I have the right to know as much about myself as anyone else does?
Genetic testing and moral dilemmas, along with questions from our audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Mash good. Easy, Igor, you impetuous young boy. Mash good, master.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is David Magnus from Stanford University School of Medicine, and we're talking about bioethics, myths, and realities.
Do you look forward to designing your next baby? Do you think your physician should withhold bad news that you can't do anything about? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone.
So, David, I know you're worried less about designer babies, although I'm still worried about that. And more about dealing with the masses of genetic information that's becoming rapidly available about all of us. Okay, so let's start here. Are there some principles or some main principle that you have in mind that should guide us in deciding how much information to gather and what to do with it once we've gathered it?
Yeah, there are some principles for thinking about it, but one of the challenges is that they're in conflict. One of the main principles in this area is respect for autonomy, respecting the decision-making of families, and especially in areas of reproduction, procreative liberty, the ability to let people make their own decisions. But countered against that are the values of beneficence and non-maleficence. You know, physicians and the medical profession generally is obligated to do as much good as possible but avoid harm. And there's a real worry that we could be harming by letting people make their own decisions.
Well, how can you be harming by letting people make their own decisions? I suppose either about my own genetic dispositions, you know, I have some terrible disease, some potential for some terrible disease, or my children, I say, my potential offspring. Tell me everything there is to know about these potential offspring and let me make the decisions. Where's the potential harm? I don't understand why the duty of beneficence gets in the way of the principle of autonomy.
So I think the worry is not about the actual terrible diseases that we have, but it actually relates to why it's been so much harder than we thought it would be to really understand genetic traits. We've had an explosion of being able to identify traits associated with common diseases, for example, but they contribute very little causally. And one of the worries that a lot of us have is that when we give information to the public or to patients for, say, four cardiovascular disease genes that they might have, if together they only contribute about 3 or 4% to the variance of that trait, it really doesn't tell you anything. But it sure sounds scary if you know that you've got four genes for an increased risk for cardiovascular disease. Well, so we're worried that people make bad decisions because they're given very misleading information.
Well, I mean, this sounds like the classic issue of paternalism. Mm-hmm. I know better than you what you should do with this information about yourself, so I just won't tell you. Is there really a conflict of principle here, or is it just that the right principle, namely, people have the right to know everything about themselves that anyone else knows, leads to difficulties? But, you know,
well, we always
so what?
We do, in fact, put limits on medicine. So, although, again, always attention, but we don't just say people can get buy any drug that they want. We have a process of regulation, and we try and make sure that when in medicine we do things, whether it's treatments or diagnostics, that the things that we're doing, the interventions we're offering to patients, are safe and effective.
Okay, you don't let people just have access to any medicine. That's okay, I understand that. So you can't take this narcotic just because you want this narcotic. Some physician has to prescribe it to you because the effects of sort of unregulated consumption of narcotics is really bad. Okay. But the way you're talking about genetic information is not a narcotic, it's not a drug, it's not even a treatment, it's not even a diagnosis yet. It's just information about, you know, say, your risk factor. You tell me you've got these risk factors, and then what you should tell me is, well, they're small, the percentage, you know, they have 4% probability or something like that. You tell me all the facts that you know. Now, it sounds like you don't trust people to be smart enough to understand you know, how weighty these factors are. It's like, oh my God, I've got a risk for it, whatever, and it's in my genes, and oh God, you know, it sounds like you don't trust them to be smart enough.
Well, I think that's something that we really need to make sure that it is safe before we give information. I think we need to make sure that we know what the impact of the information is. The thing that concerns me
is... You don't mean medically safe. You mean safe for them to know.
Well, exactly. But diagnostics is a part of medicine. We regulate and control other parts of diagnostics just like we do the other parts of medicine, but not as much. And I do worry that, you know, giving information is an intervention, just like giving a drug or doing a surgical procedure is, and we should make sure that it's a safe and effective one.
That just seems to me dubious. When you buy a house, you are entitled, everybody agrees, it's by law, to scads of information, most of which you really could care less about, right? But you have to sit there and sign paper after paper that you know that there was a gas station 6 blocks away that once had a problem with a leaky gasoline container and, you know, blah, 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 blah. Now, I'm sure some people are intensely interested in this. Some people, like me, kind of wait for the high points and just sign most of the stuff. But the government didn't have to do a lot of research and say, well, this is going to have a good result to tell people that there's a flood in their house every so often. I mean, if some people, if they're told there's a 100-year flood, they might have a heart attack and die just to hear that. Maybe we should do 10 or 12 years of controlled experiments to see whether it's safe to tell people that their house is likely to flood, even if it's just a 100-year flood. Only physicians would think that the information they have about me is something that they should decide whether to give me based on their decision about what I would do about it.
What do you say about that?
Isn't that kind of, yeah.
So it depends partly on the details. If the if people disclose information about a house that was likely to lead them astray in making the decisions, maybe make a house sound better than it really is, mm-hmm. in very systematic ways that maybe other people understand, then I think it is legitimate to raise that as a concern. And I'll just say that in practice, this is what happens now in genetics. There are decisions about which tests are going to be offered and which aren't going to be offered when we do newborn testing. And right now in clinical genetics, when we do screening, geneticists actually make that decision about what information is going to be disclosed and which isn't going to be disclosed. And that's really the source of a lot of the fighting right
now. Geneticists make that decision about what's going to be disclosing isn't to the subject, the patient. And I can imagine doctors making decisions about what's going to be closed to the patient, the subject. But, you know, I know what kind of society we live in. I know. Despite Obamacare, we still live in a basically capitalist-driven insurance regimen. And I can't imagine a scenario in which this kind of information will be kept out of the hands of insurers. And I can't imagine a scenario in which it's legitimate to let the insurers have this information and make decisions on the basis of it. They're going to use complicated actuarial. They're not going to make statistically bad inferences. They're going to make statistically good inferences. I can't imagine a regime in which it's okay for them to do that, but not okay for me to know.
You're kind of being attacked from both sides.
Yeah. I'm skeptical that the insurers will get that except via the medical record. And it's really about what book belongs in the medical record.
Have you seen capitalism work?
No, I do. I think you have a point, but it's not really a worry about insurance. I think, you know, I said what I think should happen. If you ask me to predict what will happen, I think the way capitalism is going to have an influence here, we're already seeing with companies like 23andMe, it's that people want to know this information. There's going to be companies that are going to be set up to give it to them. And then once that's out there, right now anybody can be genotyped.
So just what's 23andMe?
So that's a direct-to-consumer company that will allow anybody to be genotyped.
Right. So here's another kind of worry. I can imagine you could say, well, it's not medically indicated that you should have this test. And then an insurer, say, is not going to pay for this test. And if the test is exorbitant, people without means are not going to get this test. But even if it's not medically indicated, are you going to have the government say, well, you can't pay for this with your wealth from a third-party provider? No, that's not going to happen. That might happen in a more socialist, top-down economy, but it's not going to happen here.
And I think that's the fear that many of us have.
Yeah, okay, so now what's going to happen? We're going to have this inequality. Poor people are going to have less access to their genetic information than well-off people, and then, you know?
And this is one area where the poor people might be better off.
What's the argument for that? That's the I don't get. I know you...
Well, so
I see that it follows from your argument.
Right.
But.
So a lot of the information is misleading, and a lot of it is unknown. So you have a lot of difficulties. What do you say to somebody when we have genetic findings of unknown significance, which is incredibly common? So you have, it's one thing to, when you have a test where you know exactly what it means, and I think that's what we envision when we think about genetic testing. I know exactly what it means. Most of the time, it's either tests that are not predictive, it's hard to interpret, but it looks significant, and that's fraught with problems. It may not be replicable. And so that leads to the potential that people are going to get very different results. In fact, in testing, when the Government Accounting Office did some testing of these direct-to-consumer companies, they found they got different results from different companies because depending on the particular algorithm they use, you could get different results. And my favorite line in that GAO report, somebody said, look, if you really want the best DNA test possible right now, get somebody's family history, get their DNA, throw away the DNA, and base all your predictions on the family history.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the myths and reality of bioethics with David Magnus from Stanford University. We're in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater, and we've got some questions from that live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Thank you. My name is Zeev, and I'm from Mountain View. And my question was regarding that 25-year rule. And I wonder, suppose that the framers of the Constitution only thought about the next 25 years, and maybe it would have made sense to have an autocratic rule, but really in the 100-year, 200-year future, it made more sense to have a divided government, and we see that borne out. So how would the 24-hour rule apply in that situation?
So I think when it comes to assessing technologies, the reason why we get nervous for things that are more than 25 years on the horizon, it's really not clear whether that it's 25 or 100 or 200 or when. And there's too many other parts of the context and the way that science might develop to really know. There's so many pathways that things might take that it's really challenging to really do very much when you're thinking about what policies ought to be developed, what are the really fundamental ethical issues. So I think it's most of us are very skeptical about science fiction scenarios that go too far down the road.
We might draw a lesson from our founding fathers. It's better to be very specific than use vague terms that may change their extension. It'd be better to say, since militias are important, the right to own muskets and really primitive handguns shall not be abridged.
But back to the 25-year rule and technology, yeah, that certainly has to be true. I mean, think 25 years ago, and some of you may be too young to remember this, I used to watch, Walter Cronkite had, it was more than 25 years ago, the 21st century, and all these things are going to happen in the 21st century, and think of the cartoon, The Jetsons. I grew up thinking by now we'd be having jetpacks and flying cars and all this sort of stuff, and then there's a whole bunch of stuff that has emerged that nobody imagined, right? So you never know where technology is going to go. I think that's certainly right.
I find the 25-year rule very comforting. I'm not going to worry about these things.
Thanks for the question. Let's take one more question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk Now.
Hi, I'm Susan from Berkeley, and I've had my gene sequenced, as a consumer, and I just thought it was so fascinating. It's now $99, so it's pretty accessible. But then I was talking to a friend and saying, oh, man, you ought to go do this. It's just so interesting. And she said she didn't think she wanted to do this because the life insurance forms ask her if she had any genetic information. Now, I understand getting in a health care plan that's not supposed to make a difference, but I hadn't thought of this one.
I think that's a good point. The Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act, GINA, does prevent any discrimination for job or for health insurance, but it does allow life insurance companies or disability insurance to take that into account. I will say that in practice, it's not clear that most of the information that you get from most of these testing, as I've indicated, really have enough predictive power or value for it to be of any interest to most of those companies. But there are a few exceptions. But the exceptions are not about the complex traits. It's really about those Mendelian traits and those Mendelian diseases.
Tell us what you mean by Mendelian trait.
So those really are the non-complex traits that fall into don't have multiple genes involved, but really have a single gene disorders where there's a very causal power there. So, for example, BRCA genes contribute to a dramatically increased risk of developing breast cancer. And depending on what company you use for your genotyping, one minor correction: it wouldn't have been sequencing if it was $99; it would have been genotyping. But if they did genotyping, they actually, for example, 23andMe does look at that. There's a Mendelian trait for increased risk of Parkinson's, and they do include that. Those are things that the life insurance company might very well take into account.
So let me ask you another question. I'm going to take you back to designer babies and getting it in through the back door. At least, I mean, yeah, we can't reach in there and manipulate the genes to give people just the traits we want. But with genetic screening, right, you can take, as I understand it, you can take one cell from an embryo that consists of 8 cells, and you can map its genome, right? And you can see that it's got these various Mendelian disease traits, and you can say, I'm not going to implant that one. I mean, people do this with in vitro fertilization. I'm not going to implant that one. I am going to implant that one. I mean, look, the upside of this seems to me to say all these diseases that have a genetic factor, we can eliminate those diseases through the wise use of genetic screening and the Gattaca thing, where we basically say, don't have your kid the natural way. Let us do it in vitro so that we can screen out these diseases. We can eliminate them, at least the genetic contribution to them from the human species.
Well, we can certainly dramatically reduce them. I don't know if we can eliminate them as long as there are, you know, wine and bad judgments.
Right.
People will have kids the old-fashioned way.
But at least it seems at least biologically possible that we could engineer at least these kind of traits out of the human genome.
I think we can certainly dramatically reduce their incidence. And you don't even have to go to IVF. There are companies that have now been set up just in the last couple of years to do what's called carrier screening. And I have to say, this is something that, as an Ashkenazi Jew, something I'm very familiar with. Tay-Sachs disease, which is a terrible genetic disease, has almost been eliminated from the Ashkenazi Jewish population by carrier screening. Well, now, because of these new technologies, you can have hundreds or even thousands of Mendelian traits, which are all individually very rare, but collectively have a big impact, and you can actually do carrier screening so that when you decide whether you're going to who you're going to marry or whether you're going to have kids together, you can make choices so that you can avoid those diseases.
So isn't there a bit of a, I don't know if danger is the right word, but I mean, suppose that manic depression is something that is a fairly small number of indicators for, but might that not correlate with something that we find very valuable? If we didn't have the manic depression gene, we wouldn't have great composers and great mathematicians. I mean, maybe I'm making a generalization here, but most of the people that are great composers and great mathematicians strike me as a bit unbalanced.
Yeah. I think you are making a generalization here, Tom.
I think it's actually turned out, so for psychiatric disorders, which we know have a heritable component, mm-hmm. schizophrenia, manic depression, those have turned out to be extremely hard to get genes that have very much causal power. Mm-hmm. So I don't see any likelihood that we're going to be able to eliminate those from the population anytime soon.
Well, that's a relief.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. This time we're talking about the myths and realities of bioethics with David Magnus, co-editor of the book with a very intriguing title, Who Owns Life?
Biology, at long last, seems to be pushing us into that brave new world that Aldous Huxley worried about so long ago. In the next segment, we'll consider what policies should guide us in dealing with that brave new world.
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the Bay Area's breeding ground for new performance. We'll take more questions from our audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is David Magnus, director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at Stanford University. We're in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater, and we've got more questions from that audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, sir.
Mark Miller from Berkeley. My question is about the Chinese and research into general intelligence. Or the supposed heritability or even existence of general intelligence. The Chinese have a substantially different ethical framework than we do as far as about abortion, privacy, personal rights versus the state, even intelligence. It's very controversial here, and it's less so there. When I hear things about a zillion loci determining intelligence or 25 years out, I'm reminded of Ventnor's task of sequencing the genome. Everyone said 30 years, he did in 3. I think Ventnor is going to come from China. His name is going to be Stephen Su, and he's going to be at the Beijing Genomics Institute where they have more sequencers in one building than the entire U.S. combined. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little dubious about these retrenchment kind of statements that we won't have these breakthroughs when they are happening, they're just not happening here.
Yeah. Well, so the reason why I think it's going to be so long is not because it's of a lack of technology, which was the case in the Venter case. It's really about learning more about how genes work and a better understanding. Because there's been an explosion in identifying genes that contribute to lots of traits with GWAS studies, but a lot depends on finding out more about how genes work. And I can tell you what my guess is for most of these kinds of complex traits like those involved in genetics. Is it's going to turn out that large parts of the genome each contribute a tiny little bit to a lot of traits, just a small amount. And if that turns out to be the case, it's going to be almost impossible to ever really take advantage of that information in any kind of engineering
fashion. Why is that going to be impossible? Because I'm not up on this field, but I know a fair amount about dynamic systems theory, and you have like a connectionist network. You can have a whole bunch of nodes in the network playing a very small part. And just by organizing them, you can use learning algorithms to do the organizing. You get each of these little things working together in a dynamic system gives you this complicated output where you might have been looking for some distinct module to do the work. I mean, it sounds like when I say all, this is a big deal. It sounds like we just need a kind of model, a kind of dynamic systems theory model to aggregate up from how these genes work together to give rise to these things, and then ways of tuning them. Why is that necessarily 25 years off? Why isn't some really smart geneticist who's alive to dynamic systems theory, couldn't that just be around the corner through a massive burst of insight?
Well, I think it's going to be longer than that to be able to understand the genome. But if it really works the way I've described, being able to control it is going to be much, much harder. The ability to actually manipulate and make decisions. When you do PGD, for example, you've only got 12 embryos that you're selecting from among, or maybe 15 under the best circumstances. And that's just not going to give you the kind of power you need. And even the current methods or any methods on the horizon for gene transfer, it's just not going to be able to get you what you need once you've got hundreds or thousands of genes involved.
So I read this thing about, I heard a report on NPR, so I trust it. It's not the internet. But the Japanese made mice eggs from stem cells, right? Mm-hmm. So now imagine I could make a bunch of eggs from stem cells and fertilize them. Instead of having 8 embryos, I have thousands of them because I make them for free using the stem cell technique, and I just do some screening and I get these total packages.
So again, work on trying to develop eggs, gametes basically, from stem cells. Exciting area of research, lots of stuff going on. Again, a long way away from us being able to, for humans. And especially when you're thinking about actually applying it in humans, we can't forget the regulatory system that we're in, where when you get something that looks, even if we get to the point where it looks promising, you're talking about probably another 10 years.
Yeah, but still, it sounds like you want me to take comfort in the long way offness, not the in principle impossibility.
Yes.
Because some smart person working, and since the payoff is so high, right? That's why the Chinese are pouring resource after resource, because the payoff, even if it's a hard problem, the payoff for solving it is enormous.
Actually, I'm skeptical of that. The idea that we would ever get to the point where to be able to take advantage of growing genetic knowledge, that we would use stem cells to create thousands of embryos, fertilize them, select among thousands for reproduction. If that happens, that's going to be very much a boutique practice and not a very prominent form of reproduction.
Now, let me ask you a little bit different question. Earlier in the last segment, you considered the possibility that for an individual human, knowledge about that human might be something that he or she shouldn't be given because they would do something stupid with it. It would have a bad effect on them. Now, isn't what's possible for the individual also what's possible for the species? Mightn't it be that we're pouring lots of money and energy into finding out something that there's no chance that we'll use responsibly and that will make our life better? Isn't it possible that instead of worrying about Iran and their nuclear bomb, we should be worrying about China and their genetic bomb, that it's really more of a danger to the American way of life than Iran's joining the long list of countries that have nuclear weapons?
Yeah, I think the concerns that I have about China when it comes to genetics is not that it's going to become a challenge to our way of life. I think most of the big challenges there, as was mentioned by one of the commentators earlier, they do have a very different ethical framework. They have very different laws and rules governing reproduction. And so the risks that I think are more real are already there, which is using amniocentesis combined with aborting of unwanted female fetuses has produced skewed sex ratios. That's a very concrete application of the technology that I think is problematic. And I think that's an example of where we have to look at the collective consequences of allowing individual decision making, because it can have deleterious consequences. In China, 20% of males will not be able to marry someone of the opposite sex.
How about if it was the other way around? We know that males are responsible for approximately 96% of the violence in the world. In all other domesticated species, we cut down on the number of males. What if the Chinese were verging the other way? Wouldn't that be a good idea?
Maybe. <That's not laughs>
Let's take a question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi. This is Nate from San Francisco. Short question here. Do we have reason to believe in the human ability not only to biologically design, but also undesign? And then finally here, or can we make a permanent mistake?
Yeah, so that gets to some of the concerns about germline interventions and things where you do different kinds of engineering that would potentially be passed on to next generations. I mean, as you can tell, I'm certainly concerned about the uses of technology and the uses of genetics and control over it and the use of physicians, but I'm much more sanguine about some of these kinds of larger genetic engineering issues. I mean, I think the fears are there, the fears about these things happening. You can see it in the Promethean imagery and technology. I think when Dolly the sheep first came out, the Sistine Chapel cover and different versions of that appeared over and over again. The language of Frankenfoods and Frankenfish in genetic engineering in the non-human realm, all these highlight, I think, Promethean fears that people have, and it plays out in our science fiction. But in spite of those kinds of deep-rooted, visceral concerns that the public has, I think that on the whole, on balance, the potential value of the technology exceeds these problems, but you have to really have to get a handle on, I think, the more concrete, immediate problems rather than the science fiction stories.
Okay, so we'll give you an opportunity to do that. So as we've talked about the myths and realities of bioethics, I've asked myself, suppose David were czar for a day, in charge of, or a week, or a couple of months, with regard to all these issues, genetic research, genetic testing, treatment. What's the main policy that you would enact during your czardom?
Right. So the big change that I would make, and it would be a pretty radical transformation of the way we're developing genetic technology, is to recognize genetic testing as a medical procedure, and therefore to have it regulated to make sure that it's safe and effective before it's used. That would completely change the way we're developing the technology right now, and I think it would be, of great benefit to the way it's used in medicine.
So you, medical procedure, that means something like, in order to perform it, a doctor has to believe it's medically indicated. There has
Correct.
To be some diagnostic criteria or something to go
Correct.
On. But does that mean, though, I mean, so this takes us kind of full circle back to the beginning. What are you going to say to the private provider who sees a profit motive and the guy and the person with the money who's interested in, are you going to regulate the economy in such a way to prohibit that kind of free exchange of commerce?
Again, if I was the czar, if I'm the czar, I have the FDA regulate this, which is right now the FDA is deciding whether it's going to go into this area and regulate it, and nobody's quite sure what they're going to do. But that's if I was in control, I would have the FDA regulate.
So I'm not quite sure what the principle. I see the policy, but I'm not quite sure what the principle behind the policy is, except that people are too stupid to make good use of this. Well, I mean, is that a crude statement?
Pretty solid principle.
Yeah. But it's even maybe a little bit more than that. If you really accept that this is that giving genetic information about health risks is a medical process, is part of medicine, then it's really important that it be done right, and that it be accurate, that the information be correct, and actionable.
I think though that sometimes physicians lack a little imagination about what people might do with this knowledge. For example, There's Alzheimer's in my family. I'm 70 years old. I'd kind of like to know whether I have the gene that predisposes me towards Alzheimer's. My doctor says, well, there's nothing we can do about it, so what would be the point of knowing? Well, the point of knowing would be, if I don't have it, maybe I'll start a really long book. I mean, writing a really long... If I do have it, I'll look for some essay that might be fun to write over and over and over. But, I mean, you know, there are... One can plan their life around things that just because they can't be cured. But I think physicians think, well, if you can't cure it, if there's nothing you can do about it medically, then there's really no reason my patient should know about it.
Well, I don't think that's really the way in which they limit this. So if you wanted to know about your APOE4, which is a particular allele that increases risk of Alzheimer's, I think that would be a legitimate thing to ask, and I'm sure that you could have a physician do testing for this. I'm not sure that because there's nothing that can be done, I'm not sure your insurance company would pay for mm-hmm. it, but you could certainly get a physician to order the APOE4 test. But what about other genes that are out there that, because of GWAS studies, have also been associated with Alzheimer's disease, but the odds ratios are so low that knowing your result actually doesn't tell you anything about whether you really have an increased risk. Is it okay for you to say that you'd like to have the information about that genetic test, which won't actually tell you about whether you're at increased risk really, but it's still called an Alzheimer's disease gene?
I take your point, but you know, I just wonder about the rise of fad diets and pseudo-nutrition science. It's all over the place. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's anything the FDA or anybody's going to do to stop that. So if you say doctors, blah, 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 behave suchly, I still think you can have all the other people out there, and it's going to happen. Last thought, what do you think about that? There's no way you're going to keep this genie out of the bottle.
Well, if you ask the question, my prediction about what's going to happen, my prediction is the FDA will choose not to regulate it, and I think it is going to be out there. The state of California, in a way, is a good little test case. When 23andMe and some of these other companies first started operating, we have a lot of state laws requiring that only physicians can order complex tests, and there have to be state licenses, and so the California Department of Public Health sent cease and desist letters to all these companies. When 23andMe started using some of their political muscle, they were basically granted waivers, essentially, and allowed to continue to operate.
On that uplifting note, our guest has been David Magnus. He's director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the Stanford School of Medicine, and he's co-author of Who Owns Life? David, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, John, you started out such a gung-ho optimist, unworried about the future. Is that still where you are?
No. I was just kind of role-playing. I'm not an optimist about
much of anything.
Much of anything. David's a very impressive young man. It seems like just yesterday he was in our seminars. And I'm willing to grant that sometimes it's good for philosophers to go off and do things that have an answer to the so what question.
Yeah. I guess I'm still worried. My last thought is I'm still worried about the far off possibilities, because I think the confidence that we'll never figure this stuff out, that it's so hard. Science has figured out amazing things. If we can figure out quantum theory, you know, we can figure out this complex interaction of genes. I'm sure there are computationally harder problems that we've already tracked, and we just need some time and some resources. So I think the floodgates are going to open someday, and I don't think we're going to be ready when the floodgates
open. I'm pretty sure that culture will evolve in such a way that normal human lives in 50 or 100 years are something that I would look on from my present perspective with great distaste. But I think that's true of my life compared to what my great-grandfather would have looked on. And so it's dubious to say, well, if it happens and the people that it happens to like it, it must be okay. That's not quite right. But it's also, you don't want to overemphasize the distaste with which we look on the perhaps inevitable results of our own gaining of knowledge.
Right. This conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. You can also find out more by visiting our Facebook page. You can follow our tweets on Twitter. And you can get the free weekly podcast of Philosophy Talk at our website, philosophytalk.org.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2013.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Music from Amy Kessler, Carola Kreitmar, and Joshua Raul Brody, the Platons.
Special thanks to Eric Blazeski and Stephanie Weissman. Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Caitlin Esch, Neil Tanner, and Elise Sugarman.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Dave Millar is our director of marketing.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.